From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Although many folks from all over the political spectrum are a bit gobsmacked by a number of Donald Trump appointees, there are some who are saying, what's the big deal?
So when people look around and look for conservative leadership and people who can get the job done, they want a Floridian to do the job.
Also this week, fear is growing among many immigrant communities, even those with legal status, in response to Donald Trump's deportation promises.
And we happen to have the largest number of Venezuelans and Haitians right here in Florida.
We'll also revisit the topic of how the Democrats lost traction among so many Hispanics, and we'll see how a statewide movement to provide more services for kids is working out. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report. President-elect Donald Trump has tapped four Florida Republicans to high-level roles in his administration. Tristan Wood reports none of them have gotten as much national attention as his decision to select now former Panhandle Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz to be the U.S. Attorney General.
Trump's decision to tap Gaetz has turned heads. One of those surprised was Florida Democrat political consultant Steve Shale, who first met Gaetz when he was a lawmaker in the state legislature. He says he was bombarded by texts after the Gaetz announcement.
Literally, it was just driving down the road and my phone is sitting on my lap, just, you know, exploding, like something literally wrong with it. And I think when I counted up, I had something like 80 text messages in maybe 10 or 15 minutes. And what was comical about it was it didn't matter if they were Republican or Democrat. Every text message was the same, like, oh my God, what is this?
Gaetz's nomination has been met with harsh condemnation from a variety of sources, from legal organizations who worry about his thin legal resume to the conservative editorial magazine The National Review, which labeled him as, quote, unconfirmable. And then there was Democrats like Orlando State Representative Anna Eskamani, who points to the ongoing sex trafficking allegations Gaetz has dealt with for years.
One of the most horrifying picks for Attorney General, I think, in modern American history. Matt Gaetz is not qualified to be the Attorney General. And I think what's even more concerning is that he's under investigation. And so the idea that someone who is potentially breaking the law would be charged with upholding the law is nonsensical.
The Justice Department closed an investigation into the allegations with no charges filed, while a Congressional House ethics probe appears to be at a standstill since Gaetz resigned from the chamber upon his attorney general nomination. It's unclear whether the results of that probe will be released. Gaetz has been a staunch supporter of President-elect Trump, even at times angering many in his own party. Still, many Florida Republicans, including state GOP chair Evan Power, have stood by the firebrand.
Matt has been a long-term friend of mine. I think he's extremely qualified as a lawyer and will represent the state of Florida well as Attorney General and serve our country well.
Aside from Gaetz, three other Republicans, Marco Rubio, Michael Waltz, and Susie Wiles, have been tapped for roles in the Trump administration. Power says that speaks to how dominant Florida Republicans have been in charting the course for conservatives.
Florida has become the conservative leader for the nation. And so when people look around and look for conservative leadership and people who can get the job done, They want a Floridian to do the job. I think that the saying has been, if you need a job done, you send a Florida man or woman.
University of Central Florida political science professor Aubrey Jewett says Florida Republicans are doing well, but thinks the number of appointments from the Sunshine State has more to do with Trump currently calling Florida home and wanting to surround himself with people he knows are loyal.
You know, you combine the fact that Trump actually lives here with the fact that we have so many Republicans that live here and are very supportive of Trump. That's why you're seeing a number of Floridians being picked for spots in his administration.
Of the Florida appointees that need U.S. Senate approval, Gaetz may be the only one to face difficulty getting confirmed. Some senators have expressed everything from skepticism to outright rejection of him due to his opinions on everything from ousting Florida Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy to backing January 6 protesters. Republicans have a 53-seat lead in the chamber, meaning four people in his own party would have to turn their back on Gaetz for him not to be confirmed. I'm Tristan Wood.
Even immigrants with lawful status are bracing for President-elect Donald Trump's promise of mass deportations. We get more on that story from WLRN's Tim Padgett.
We will begin the largest deportation operation in the history of the United States.
Few Donald Trump campaign promises have caused as much anxiety as his plan for a mass deportation of all undocumented or removable immigrants, as many as 13 million people. It could affect a million people living and working in Florida. Now that former President Trump is, again, President-elect Trump, that prospect has undocumented migrants like Maria of Miami in a high state of dread.
Right now, everybody is at risk. Everybody is in danger. What will happen to thousands that have been here for decades?
Maria, who asked us not to use her last name, came to the U.S. as a computer student after Hurricane Mitch destroyed her native Nicaragua in 1998. She arrived too late to apply for temporary protected status, or TPS, which shields migrants from disaster or conflict-torn countries from deportation. Since then, Maria has worked, paid taxes, and hoped the federal government would extend TPS to the thousands of Nicaraguan migrants like her, especially now that Nicaragua is ruled by a brutal dictatorship.
If I have to go back to Nicaragua, it's going to be horrible. I'm not even sure if they're going to let me in.
That's why Maria is imploring President Biden to grant that TPS protection before he leaves office and Trump occupies the White House in January.
People are scared. People calling me and telling me, what can we do? And I have no answers.
Daniela is a migrant from Venezuela, itself under a brutal dictatorship and the worst humanitarian crisis in modern South American history. Daniela, who also asked us not to use her last name, received TPS 3 years ago and now works in a medical clinic here. But like many TPS recipients, she fears Trump will eliminate that protected status, as he tried to do during his first presidency but was blocked by the courts, and leave her undocumented again.
I hope everything I'm hearing, everything they're saying is not true. But I think he doesn't care under which circumstances you are. He just wants to take everyone out of the country.
Immigration advocates agree that the migrants most people think of as undocumented, farm, restaurant, and construction workers, for example, may not be the most vulnerable under Trump's deportation plan. That's because they tend to dwell deeper underground and are harder for immigration authorities to find. As a result, it's the migrants who are here lawfully, but could easily have that lawful status taken away by, say, executive order, who may be in Trump's crosshairs instead.
You do not begin by going blind. You begin by going with what you know.
Oscar Chacon is co-founder and senior strategy advisor for the nonprofit Alianza Americas in Chicago. Alianza is a coalition of immigrant advocacy organizations that several Florida groups have partnered with to prepare for Trump's deportation plan.
The people they know about are people who have had some sort of relationship with the system.
Chacon points out that along with TPS holders, that includes DACA recipients or DREAMers, those who were brought to the U.S. as young children, or migrants whose asylum cases are pending, or those here on the new 2-year humanitarian parole.
All those programs emanate essentially from executive branch discretion. Keep in mind that Trump did try to terminate DACA, did try to end TPS, but they did not follow proper procedure. But I am sure they've learned their lessons.
All of which is why immigrant advocate leaders in South Florida are bracing for serious legal battles with Trump. Tessa Petit is executive director of the Florida Immigrant Coalition in Miami.
The largest communities with TPS status are Venezuelans and Haitians. And we happen to have the largest number of Venezuelans and Haitians right here in Florida. If he eliminates TPS for them, and then we also have the bulk of the folks who came in on parole, then we're going to face the harshest part of it.
Many analysts say the tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars such a massive deportation would cost to carry out makes it less likely. They add it could also do massive damage to the U.S. economy, since so many sectors depend on migrant labor. In Florida alone, it's estimated undocumented migrants pay almost $2 billion in taxes. But the politics are in Trump's favor. Recent polls show most Americans favor his deportation plan. I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
Republicans around the nation, and especially in Florida, toppled Democrats in the November elections. President-elect Donald Trump made massive gains in the Sunshine State. Governor Ron DeSantis helped defeat two controversial ballot proposals, and the GOP held onto supermajorities in the Florida House and Senate. On the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast, University of Florida political science professor Daniel Smith talks about voter turnout, the ballot initiative process, and the state's significant shift to the right. Here's an excerpt.
Do you have any other big takeaways from turnout and either the way people voted or where they voted or didn't vote from Tuesday night?
This was a uniform shift. We saw it across all counties in Florida. We saw it across all jurisdictions where Trump did better. Rick Scott did better. Rick Scott, you know, a guy who can barely win an election, did the best he's ever done. And it wasn't in one area in particular. If you look at Miami-Dade, for instance, I can't remember what the shift was. Something like a 29-point shift from Clinton to Trump. And then another 11 points with Trump to Harris. So that's a 40-point shift from 2016, where Clinton beat Trump by 29 points in Miami-Dade. Trump beats Harris by 11 points, a 40-point shift. And you think, what's the cause of that? In a decade. That's insane. Mm. And that's not just Cubans coming out in force, although they did. Mm-hmm. It's not just Cuban Americans voting for Trump, which they did. Mm-hmm. It's also meaning a lot of other folks in the county didn't turn out to vote, who might have voted for the Democratic candidate. And there are people, no party affiliates, without question, younger, no party affiliates, because I can see that from the data who were turning out in Miami-Dade, much more so than other counties that have sizable Hispanic populations. The turnout, I put this together looking at turnout. Turnout wasn't massive in Miami-Dade. The numbers I have right now, Miami-Dade's overall turnout was only about 72%, and all the numbers aren't in. But Orange County was around 72%. Osceola was around 74%. So it's not just the turnout, it's who turned out. Mm-hmm. And those are among the bottom of mm-hmm. turnout for the state. And that's out of the denominator there is active voters, not all voters. But whatever, it's you know, pretty good gauge. Turnout wasn't massive in Miami-Dade, which means that two things are happening. One, certain demographics aren't turning out to vote, and those that did are changing their preferences. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that the Democratic Party has to really grapple with in terms of where is the Hispanic voice.
That was University of Florida political science professor Daniel Smith on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast from the News Service of Florida. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. The latest uniform crime figures from the FBI show that Florida ranks second among the states, behind only California, when it comes to fraud schemes targeting senior citizens.
1,000 complaints of elder fraud filed just last year alone. Some of those victims saying they were cheated out of their entire life savings. Now, these scams come in all shapes and sizes, everything from fake lotteries to phony investment schemes. But here in Marin County, they say the most lucrative schemes they're seeing involve online romances.
That's just one among dozens of Florida news stories about the problem, but it seems the news isn't getting through to a lot of prospective attorneys in this country. That's why Ted Merman is crisscrossing the nation, delivering an urgent message to law students. He dropped by the Florida State University College of Law last month to address students and faculty there.
Part of it will be on senior-related issues, and part of it will be on the general effort to raise the profile of consumer law and economic justice in law schools around the country. That's a program that we run out of the center at Berkeley.
That's the Center for Consumer Law and Economic Justice at the UC Berkeley Law School, where Merman is the director. He believes with the incidence of senior fraud exploding, this is a legal arena that far more law students need to consider.
I think it's a very important set of defenses that you're providing to students, for sure. It also gives them an immediate way to help people, including their own family, right from the beginning. A president of the United States once said, "We are all consumers, every one of us." And that is absolutely true. So it's an area that we all should be interested in.
But there may be some new challenges on the horizon. It's likely the incoming presidential administration may dismantle at least some of the current consumer law protections in favor of industry self-regulation. Merman sees this as a response that falls short.
Self-regulation, unfortunately, is susceptible to one or two members of an industry deciding that they aren't interested, and that can drag the whole industry down. So I think it makes a lot of sense to come up with a series of regulatory principles that can be put in place in law that an entire industry would then need to follow.
Merman thinks those legal protections also need to provide more aggressive enforcement mechanisms, also a challenge since so many scams have international origins.
It would also be a nice thing to see some piece of the energy and the excitement going into countering those scams and having a positive sort of arms race on the consumer side to ferret out the problems. And that will happen over time, but I think that it's something I'd like to see encouraged.
And just maybe the need to protect people, especially vulnerable seniors, from fraud may be one of those rare bipartisan issues that nearly everyone can support, regardless of politics.
I do think that eventually there's great consensus in this country about the sorts of protections that we want to have in place. Again, if it happens to you, happens to some member of your family, I have seen minds changed by having that happen. And I think that there really is more agreement than people realize about the kind of a society and a kind of a marketplace we want to live in.
In the meantime, Ted Merman will continue his pilgrimage to law schools across the country, urging more law students to consider a career in consumer law. The United Nations 2024 Global Climate Conference runs through November 22nd. Time to coincide with that, Florida Gulf Coast University is presenting 2 weeks of climate change. It's a series of events that explore local and global challenges and solutions for our changing climate. WGCU's Mike Canary talked with FGCU ecology professor Dr. Wynn Everham about the challenges of getting people to take climate change seriously.
Evidence for the changes that we've done to the atmosphere started to be collected the year I was born, in 1958. You know, long-term records of CO2 concentrations. And by the mid-1980s, the gases we were putting in the atmosphere were changing radiation balance on the Earth. And so by the time I came down here in the mid-90s, the sense in the ecological community was that this was going to be a huge shaping force in the next century. You know, as initially people thought about rising temperatures translated into rising sea levels. And at that time, as I engaged my ecology classes, my environmental studies classes, I think in my head, I'm thinking this is something the next generation is going to have to deal with. This is something that we're going to see probably after I'm dead. And then I'd say Charley in 2004, you know, the first hurricane we had here in four and a half decades. And then 13 years later, Irma, and then 5 years later, Ian, then 2 years later, Milton. Someplace in between the Irma, Ian, Milton, I think everybody who pays attention realized, oh, it's here. You know, climate change isn't the future, it's here now. It's climate is shifting our weather every day.
I Google searched FGCU 2 weeks of climate change, and the top four links were of information about it. And the fifth link was a Reddit post titled, "At what point will Florida become unlivable?" And the top comment on that thread was, "I think the more pertinent question is, when will it become uninsurable?" And the reason I bring that up is because people might say the weather isn't changing even though they see it changing, but people can't say my insurance bills aren't going up. And it seems pretty clear there's a link between those two. So I guess the question is will financial issues make it something that people finally come around to knowing that we need to address?
I like your connection there, right? That we can pretend that we can't read a graph, you know, that the data is not correct. But we get a bill for our insurance. And insurance companies are in business to make money. And the reason that the cost for our insurance is going up is that they're reading the future accurately about places on our landscape which are likely to be hit by 100-year flood events every decade. And that is really going to, oh gosh, it has to change the way that we put humans on this landscape. It doesn't mean we have to leave Florida. It means we've got to be smarter about the reality of climate change impacts on our weather and the impacts that will have on our economy. And if we pretend it's not happening, we're never going to have those conversations about how to solve it.
We just had an election. A majority of voters in this country chose a candidate and a party, which, if not outright denying man-caused climate issues, are certainly resistant to taking action when it means economic disruption in any way.
Yeah, it is a challenge when our next president has falsely claimed that climate change is a hoax. You know, our climate's changing. It's affecting our economy. It's affecting our weather. It's affecting where people can live. It's affecting insurance rates. So I want to hope that we can get past what might have been election rhetoric to reality and figure out ways where we can start talking about how we can move towards better.
That was Florida Gulf Coast University ecology professor Wynn Everham speaking with WGCU's Mike Canary. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida has 11 children's services councils, with more counties interested as funding shortages for such services grow. These groups are taxpayer-funded entities that voters approve to provide more services to children where there's a gap in that county. As Margie Menzel reports, some Florida CSCs have been around for decades, while others are newer, complete with growing pains.
Former Miami Herald publisher David Lawrence once led a statewide task force on school readiness. He says he learned about the extraordinary number of children who aren't ready for kindergarten and the fact that they may never read well.
I didn't know that 85% of brain growth occurs by the age of 3 and a lot of other things. I came to think that the future of this republic depended on getting more people educated, and the key would be to get started off right.
An earlier effort to pass a Children's Services Council in what was then Dade County had failed overwhelmingly. Lawrence found ways to make it more palatable, such as putting a 5-year sunset on it.
Telling folks, try this for 5 years, and if you don't like it, you can dump it. I raised a good deal of money. I didn't run a campaign on the side of the angels, though I think this is on the side of the angels. I ran it on the basis of its practical as well as moral imperative.
In 2002, the proposal passed 2-1. 6 years later, with the Children's Trust coming up for renewal, county residents voted 84.5% in favor of keeping it.
Meaning fundamentally, we had kept the trust.
Lawrence says the word trust is in the Miami organization's name deliberately. More recently established CSCs are still having to fight for theirs. Paul Mitchell is the treasurer of the Leon County CSC. He recently pushed back on a proposal from the county and the city of Tallahassee to share funding.
Help me get comfortable with how we are not violating the provision of the statute as well as the will of the voters. The will of the voters was, we have a deficit of programs to be delivered to kids. The CSC is only allowed to fund those programs which fall into that deficit bucket.
According to state law, CSCs cannot duplicate existing services, nor can their funding be used as a replacement for existing resources. In Escambia County, a different financial fight is also in progress. The county commission wants its CSC to pay taxes and to use the money for infrastructure projects. Holly McPhail is an independent contractor who worked in the campaign to bring a Children's Services Council to Leon.
Escambia County is the only one in the state that I know of that is requiring their CSC to, in essence, use part of its ad valorem to pay into the CRA. To my knowledge, not a single other CSC is doing that. In fact, some communities are actively stating that we're not going to do this with our CSC.
CSCs can make tempting targets for cash-strapped local governments looking for more revenues. They're pitched as efforts to support children's services, with promises made to voters that funding will only go toward those needs. But in both Leon and Escambia, some who voted for those CSCs are feeling as if they were deceived. Recently, Florida voters approved a constitutional amendment tying property taxes to inflation, something local governments worry could lead to a further decline in their revenues while their need for services grows. McPhail says it's a challenge to provide gap services in rural, underserved counties.
Statewide, I think that there's an appetite for more CSCs forming in different parts of the state. I think that as we band together as a collective, we're going to be able to show that children and youth outcomes in communities that have CSCs are better off than in communities that don't.
Michelle Watson, CEO of the Florida Alliance of Children's Councils and Trusts, says her 11 members are required by statute to conduct a needs assessment that looks at all the needs in a community. The current 11 organizations invest $550 million annually in direct services and serve 80% of the state's birth to 18 population. But the entities take time to get up and running, and once they're functional, to find their footing.
It takes time. It takes time to complete a needs assessment. It takes time to look at the current funding landscape. It takes time to go out and do an RFP and conduct that research and evaluation. And then it takes time for multiple years of outcomes to be able to determine if you actually are moving the population outcomes of children in your communities.
But the voters' patience, Watson says, is the question. CSCs now sunset in 10 to 12 years, depending on their local ordinance.
When you first stand up a CSC, everybody is in this resource deficit mindset and have already, for lack of a better term, cannibalized each other, right? Stolen from Peter to pay Paul. And so I think what it takes, honestly, is the first 3 years is for everybody to understand that this is not going away, that these are a continuing commitment of dollars.
CSC advocates urge patience as some of the newer ones work through their conflicts. Critics, though, worry that some of the organizations could see their coffers raided for needs unrelated to social services. I'm Marty Menzel.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Tim Padgett, Derek Hamm, and Mike Canary. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.